Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Monday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, I'll be talking to the chief executive of Oxfam Ireland about a report that 11 people are dying every minute from hunger globally. We'll hear from Paul Scanlon, chief executive of the Private Security Authority. And for the first time, private security staff carrying out home repossessions and evictions will be required to be subject to legal standards, including Garda vetting. Benny Gilsonen is spokesperson of Retailers Against Smuggling. That organisation is warning that excise increases on tobacco will push consumers to growing black market purchases. Conor Goodman is of the Irish Times. We'll be talking about the best places to live in Ireland for this year. And Barry Grant is chief executive of Extern Problem Gambling. Gamblers in Ireland lost €1.36 billion last year. That's around €300 for every adult in the country. And it makes the people of Ireland the fourth biggest gamblers in the European Union. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, and you can always tweet us at KFMradio. The attention of the world for the last 16 months or so has been focused on the first pandemic in over 102 years. That didn't mean, though, that crises in other parts of societies across the globe in any way abated, while the number of people dying from hunger rose sixfold to outpace the number of COVID fatalities. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Jim Clarkin. He is chief executive of Oxfam Ireland. Jim, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
That is a staggering number of people dying from hunger and malnutrition, and the pace of that increase is breathtaking.
It really is. I mean, it's important for people to realise that over the past 20, 25 years, we've made a lot of progress in the fight against extreme poverty and extreme hunger, and things were moving broadly in the right direction, albeit not fast enough, of course, but certainly in that general direction. But in the last 18 months, we've seen a massive increase in extreme hunger. And as you say, the number of deaths, we estimate 11 people dying every single minute from hunger. And it is, you know, it continues to increase. And you're looking at, you know, three main drivers of this. So we're talking about conflict in countries like Afghanistan, in Ethiopia and South Sudan, Syria and Yemen. You're talking about the impact that climate change is having in lots of countries where, you know, the predictability of rain is very difficult to work out, and so planting crops and harvesting crops is becoming more and more difficult. And then you're talking about the effect of COVID, and COVID has pushed, and we warned of this over a year ago, it's pushed a lot of people into extreme poverty, people who were ordinarily, you know, living day to day with you know, casual employment and so on, and so much of that dried up when the pandemic hit. So it's a threefold kind of an attack, and it's very, very challenging, and the numbers are really, really staggering.
And none of those three factors are factors which are easily resolvable. We don't know when the pandemic will end and people will be able to reduce social distancing, and that people will be in areas not affected by that level of extreme poverty will be in a greater position to donate, and you will be in a better position to deploy your staff where they need to be. Conflicts in the areas that you mentioned have been ongoing for a considerable time. I would imagine they will deepen in places like Afghanistan with the withdrawal of US troops in particular, and climate change is going to take decades to address, even if that addressing began now.
Well, it's true that these are deep, challenging issues, but they are resolvable, and they're issues we've been talking about for years. On the conflict side, I mean, the international community has kind of ignored what's happening in these countries. We need protracted international engagement with countries and with the parties to various conflicts to try and to find ways to find peace, to find resolutions to these protracted problems, and to make sure that all communities are involved, particularly women in peace processes, because that means that the peace process is much more likely to survive and to last. From the climate point of view, you know, we know what needs to be done. It's great that we now have a strong bill here. But now we need to deliver on that, because bearing in mind that the people affected by climate change are not the ones that caused it, the entire carbon footprint of the continent of Africa is about 2% of the world's carbon, and yet there are people there who are now, today, not in the distant future, suffering from that. But on the COVID front, there's something we can do, and we can do it very immediately. Last week, we launched the People's Vaccine Alliance. That's a group of NGOs, medical health experts in Ireland, and a number of others, trade unions and so on, who are advocating for what they call people's vaccine. So we believe that if the government here, the government are currently blocking what's called the TRIPS waiver. So that's an option within the WTO rules to suspend intellectual property rights for vaccines, so that the vaccine, the ingredients and the know-how can be shared with companies across the world who are ready and willing to produce the stuff. But unfortunately, Ireland and Europe are not supporting this waiver. And we need them to do that. That's a game changer in terms of a lot of what we're talking about here. And there's no reason why Ireland should stand by its current position.
And I would imagine the European bloc would say, but look, we're donating loads of vaccines, and there have been a couple of hundred million. But that is a literal drop in the ocean. And one would wonder, really, what is the rationale for not supporting the TRIPS waiver? I feel that they sense that it might set a precedent, but it would be difficult to believe that that would be true.
Well, look, as you rightly point out at the start, this is a once-in-a-hundred-year situation we have with this pandemic. You know, I wouldn't worry too much about precedents. And anyway, even if we were to look at precedents, the resolution, or at least the containment of HIV and AIDS, was a direct result of the sharing of the vaccine IPA, or the medical the drug IPA at the time for treatment. So, you know, that was an absolute game changer in the fight against HIV and AIDS. And similarly, this could be done. You know, we're hearing all these kind of counter arguments, such as, you know, which is quite offensive, to be honest, to say that can the manufacturers in these countries produce them? Of course they can. India, for example, is known as the pharmacy to the world. Half of, or a large percentage of all the medications we use here are produced in India. So, and in South Africa, and there we've identified, I think it's about 144 sites across 35 countries that could produce vaccines quickly. And the problem with vaccines that we have, and we know this even from here, is that there just isn't enough supply. So, you know, it's laudable that there are some donating, and, you know, that's fine, of surplus vaccines, but it is crumbs from the table. Whereas we know there's a solution to this: produce more vaccines, produce them quickly, get them into people's arms now over the next 6 months or a year, rather than waiting. At the moment, we're looking at waiting for 2 to 3 years at least before lots of people in developing countries. In some countries, it's only 1% have received vaccines already.
Which means that if we're waiting 2 to 3 years for people in all corners of the globe, Jim, to be vaccinated, that the pandemic itself will last another 2 to 3 years.
Well, this is exactly the point. I mean, obviously, there's a huge human rights issue and a huge fairness and justice and equality issue here. But there's even a self-interest issue, because if we don't get the world vaccinated, none of us are safe. And the reason the variants will keep coming is because the virus has an opportunity to continue to morph and develop and advance. Whereas if you kill it off, if you get the world vaccinated, then that will cease, or at least it will be reduced dramatically. So it for all kinds of reasons, particularly for the right reasons, this needs to be done. And there's no reason to you know, there's no reasonable counter argument to this. I mean, it just needs to happen, and we need the Irish government to move its position.
And if this doesn't happen at a quick enough pace, and if issues such as conflict and the impact of climate change persist at their current rates, it means that 31 times the population of this island, 155 million people across the globe, Jim, will remain living in crisis levels of food insecurity.
It is, and it's an horrific scenario, and it's one that we can't allow to just watch happen. You know, we know that, you know, some of these challenges are difficult, but we need to engage with them. Others, we know we can resolve them much faster. So there's a global imperative to focus on these issues. We can't allow the level of hunger, the level of suffering, the level of destitution to continue across the world. 155 million people, I mean, it's unthinkable. So, you know, we know what the solutions are. They're not easy, but we need to engage with them, and we need to move on.
Jim Clarkin, Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us.
Want to get in touch with your favourite show on KFM? Text or WhatsApp us now on 0833 97 97 97.
Now, private security staff who carry out house repossessions and evictions will now be subject to new legal standards. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Paul Scallon. He's Chief Executive of the Private Security Authority. Paul, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
So the Private Security Services Amendment Bill has passed all stages of the Oireachtas. It means that Garda vetting, etc., will now apply to those who are carrying out house repossessions and evictions. What, apart from the general laws of the land, has applied heretofore to these staff?
Very little, Ciara. As you will be aware, there have been a number of incidents around the country over recent years in relation to repossession. So there has been no regulation as such of the people who carry out this type of work. Well, there's regulations around the court orders and applying court orders to people that can be engaged for enforcing court orders other than your maybe county registrars and so forth. There's no legislation or regulation around those people. So what the bill and now the act, when it's signed by the president, does it brings in licensing for both contractors and the employees who wish to carry out these repossession and eviction duties. And there's a new category of license for these people called enforcement guards. So they will all have to apply for a license as an enforcement guard before they can carry out this work.
So up to now, Paul, like in theory, could I have acted as, you know, private security staff committing a house repossession or an eviction, as long as I worked for a relevant company?
Well, you wouldn't even need to work for a relative company. You know, in some cases, and I suppose it would depend on who was enforcing the court order, but, you know, you could have a situation where you might just, you know, bring 10 of your pals along to carry out the repossession or the eviction. So, as I say, there has been no real regulation around this area before now.
And people will need to be Garda vetted. They could face possible imprisonment for infractions on any part of this particular legislation. What material impact do you imagine that this will have, Paul, on the day-to-day operations of staff who are carrying out evictions or repossessions?
Well, like the main aim will be to get rid of those incidents that we've seen in recent years, particularly those contentious issues. So part of our role now over the next while will be to bring in training for the employees to ensure that they're trained, that they're aware of what they're entitled to do, what their legal requirements are. As you say, they'll all be guarded vetted, so will their company directors and company shareholders and senior managers. They'll be vetted by An Garda Síochána as well. If they're foreign companies, we will be looking for foreign criminal record certificates on a par with the Garda vetting, just to make sure again that people are of fit and proper standard to carry out this work. And then we'll also be bringing in requirements for the companies around their operations in terms of recruiting staff and training of staff, making sure that, you know, they operate to the highest standards possible in this area.
Are these provisions, Paul, in your view, sufficiently robust?
I think they are. You know, we have a good record in regulating other areas of the security industry, across from cash and transit, door supervisor, security guard, private investigators. I think we've shown that regulation works in these areas and have, you know, increased and improved standards across these areas. And, you know, again, looking back on the history of these sectors, they didn't have, the greatest of records in the past, but we've seen massive improvement in recent years because of regulation, and I think the same will happen here to the people involved in this area.
It'll be an offence for a contractor or an employee to provide these kinds of services without the relevant licence that you've just mentioned, Paul, subject to a fine of up to €4,000 or 12 months imprisonment or both, and a conviction on indictment could lead to a fine or imprisonment of up to 5 years. Is that enough of a deterrent?
I think it is. In fairness, you know, we have shown in the past that people don't like to be prosecuted. You know, they prefer not to have their day in court. We did have a case there before Christmas falling out from the incident up in Roscommon where we prosecuted a contractor and that has proved to be a very successful case. And we have other cases coming before the courts for other issues. So the most powerful, I suppose, weapon we have here is we
can also prosecute anybody who engages in an unlicensed operator. So if a company tomorrow was to engage people to carry out evictions or repossessions on their part and those people didn't hold a license, well then not only is the contractor and employee liable, but also their client who engaged them in the first place can also be prosecuted. And we find that that is a bigger stick that we have, because obviously you don't want to be prosecuted for engaging unlicensed operators, and we find that it's a very effective tool in this area.
Well, Paul Scallon, Chief Executive of the Private Security Authority, thank you for your time. Coming up after the break, retailers are issuing a warning about tobacco smuggling, and we'll be talking about the best places to live in Ireland.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Retailers Against Smuggling are calling for there to be no increase in the excise on tobacco in Budget 2022 in order to act as a brake on smuggling. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Benny Gilson, and he's spokesperson for Retailers Against Smuggling. Benny, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara, for giving me the opportunity.
Delighted to do so. Now, we frequently hear of revenue customs seizures of illegal tobacco and illegal tobacco products, and whilst I don't doubt their vigilance, clearly a proportion of that smuggled product is getting through into the black market. What kind of scale of a problem are you facing here?
We have noticed in particular over the last 12 months in the smaller retail outlets a large increase in sales of genuine legitimate product. Now that is because of COVID. People were not able to travel and it meant that the same volumes weren't coming in. Over the last 2 weeks, we have noticed that customs have seized a phenomenal amount of tobacco. Only last Thursday, there was two consignments sealed, a 12-ton consignment and another consignment, which I think is around 4 ton. A week previous, there was 10 ton of tobacco seized. Now, that's an indication that these people who are bringing that tobacco in, they're not bringing it in to sell to people to roll your own.
Yeah.
They're obviously bringing it in to manufacture cigarettes in factories here in this country.
And what impact does that have on your members, Benny?
A massive impact, because the vast majority of our members would be small, independent retailers, corner shop type retailers, the vast majority of them. Now, we have 3,000 members throughout the country. And a lot of those shops would depend on the packet of cigarettes, the very same as they would depend on the paper for people to come in and buy their odd items, which they would be buying in the smaller outlets. You know, it has a devastating effect on the small trade.
Because if people aren't going in for their main item, their cigarettes, they're not going to buy those other bits and bobs out of which your members make the majority of their profit.
That is correct. It's not that we have a margin on cigarettes. The margin on cigarettes is actually, it's down as low as between 6.7 and 6.9%. It's not for the margin we have on cigarettes, but it is a product that draws people into your premises, and invariably you will sell a bottle of water, a packet of crisps, a newspaper, a bottle of milk. These are the items that the small shop need to sell to survive.
And tell me, Benny, what you know about the factories that you suspect are making cigarettes in Ireland.
Well, all I know is that 18 months, 2 years ago, there was one discovered up in Jenkinstown, up between Dundalk and Uri. And they were operating on a 24/7 shift, manufacturing cigarettes only, when the customs moved in with the Gardaí and seized product and machinery and everything that was there. The people that were working there were actually working and living in the premises. There's no doubt in my mind, with the volume of tobacco that has been seized, as I said, in the last month, that we have another factory of a similar nature operating someplace else in the country that tobacco was destined for.
Now, tobacco and alcohol are the traditional two items that are usually hit with an excise increase in the budget, and certainly in a European context, our excise levels on both are very high. You're calling on Pascal Donoghue to stay his hand this time out in order to try and stem that smuggling tide.
Oh yes, without a shadow of doubt. Like you know, I can go back to 1999, and ever since the year 1999, right up to today, we have had an increase every year on tobacco. Every year, not every year on alcohol, but alcohol has been hit as well in budgets. And like to me, you know, like it's trying to knock people from buying it is not the cure to the problem. We need, if we want to try and stop people from smoking, we need to educate them, not crucify them for buying it. Educate them, because if they increase the price with people like myself, all they're forcing those people who continue to smoke to do is go out and buy them off the illegal trade, and in saying doing that, they're buying something nobody knows what's in.
Well, Benny Gilson, and spokesperson for Retailers Against Smuggling, thank you indeed for joining us. Do remember the lines are open for your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, the Irish Times is looking at the best places to live in Ireland, and I'm joined on the line by journalist Conor Goodman. Conor, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Where did you come up with the metric for doing this? Because it's so subjective.
It is. It's a difficult one. So we ran a competition like this in 2012, and the rough method we choose is we ask members of the public to nominate a place that they love to live or that they would love to live, and tell us why they think it's great. And then we research the ones that look the most promising, and then we have a panel of judges who go out and visit them. And then we make a final decision, and there's a pretty detailed process, detailed questionnaire that has to be filled in, and then we would look at criteria like, I mean, there are subjective ones like, is a place welcoming? But then you go, well, what does a welcome mean? So you might look at, for example, the number of voluntary organisations, the number of sports clubs, is there a men's shed? So are there opportunities for people to integrate into a place if they move there?
Essentially, is there a community?
Well, community spirit is again one of the sort of one of the subjective parts. But we're also looking at are there employment opportunities? Are there transport opportunities? Can you commute easily? Is there, for example, a shared working space? Is there a viable retail environment and cafes where people can go out, do their shopping, but also socialise? So all of those things that create the fabric of a community, a lot of them are measurable, and we do measure them. Mm. And so we'd also look at things like affordability, house prices, rental opportunities. You know, are all of these things in place that make living that little bit easier? But then you're also looking you're always looking for the X factor, the thing that makes it special.
Now,
has
I know
a beautiful, physical environment, or it has got beautiful buildings, or everywhere has something good.
I know that the voting is open until the 25th of July, but by Friday, Monaghan was really streets ahead of virtually everywhere else. In total, the entire county had 136 entries, a smidge ahead of Dublin with 126. But 97 of the Monaghan nominations were for the village of Glasslough. What's so special about Glasslough?
Well, the people who live there obviously love it very much. Almost by those figures, nearly a quarter of the population of Glasslough has written a nomination, has entered it for the competition. So you would have to look very seriously at that and say, well, if there is such pride of place, then that place has to be a really, you know, a strong contender. We have to send our researchers there. We have to send our judges there to properly check it out. At the moment, we're at the nomination and entry stage, and then we get into the research phase. I think, though, you could probably conclude the fact that Monaghan is ahead of Dublin, and overwhelmingly the entries are for places not in urban areas but in rural ones. That is where you often get the greatest sense of place. You often where people have a sense of identity with my town, my village, a sense that just doesn't exist in in a lot of the suburbs of Dublin or Cork or Galway. Although there are significant entries for those as well, they tend to be again around villages like Glanmire or like Malahide or like Hoth.
And you know, it's not the people that live on O'Connell Street that are in Dublin City Centre that are voting for this. It's the people that live in areas that have retained a sense of village.
That's predominantly the case. Absolutely, you would see a place somewhere like maybe Rathmines or somewhere in Dublin like that that has a sort of a sense of an urban village. But they tend to be the element that appeals to people tends to be a definable village, definable town, and a place that has that shared community identity that you're talking about at the beginning.
I feel very sorry for Roscommon and Longford. They only have one nomination apiece. In fact, there's a huge disparity across the country in terms of the level of engagement with voting. As we've noted, Monaghan, streets ahead, really, particularly given it's per head of population at 136. Roscommon and Longford have one vote each. Mayo, for example, has 39. Limerick has 11. Us here in County Kildare, we only have 14.
Kildare is a little bit of a strange one because Kildare has, outside of Dublin or Cork, has probably the fastest growing population. In the last census, it had the fastest growing population of any county outside Dublin or Cork. So clearly people are voting with their feet in that way. Loads of people moving to Kildare, loads of people who want to commute to Dublin but also maybe be close to somewhere else or have an element of the rural experience as well. So loads of people are moving to Kildare. Just not many people have nominated their place just yet, but it's early days. There's 2 weeks to go, and usually over time, these things even out. It's not completely a numbers game. Mm. If we get an excellent nomination for Selbridge or Maynooth or Strachan, and all of those places are among the nominations so far, if we get a really excellent, convincing nomination for one of those, we would look at that just as seriously as we would look at Glasslough and County Monaghan.
And everybody can vote for their town or village up and until the 25th of July on irishtimes.com/best place. Journalist Conor Goodman, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the vast amount of money spent by people in Ireland on gambling last year. Take that, and these days now, a staggering €1.36 billion was gambled in Ireland last year, and per head of population it means €300 for every single adult was gambled. It puts Ireland fourth biggest gamblers in the European Union. To discuss this, joined on the line by Barry Grant, he's Chief Executive of Extern Problem Gambling. Barry, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi Ciara, thanks for having me on.
That's a vast sum of money.
Yeah, I think someone worked out at some stage we gamble about €10,000 every minute of every day. That'll be 24 hours a day when you average it out. So we're big-time gamblers in this country. Now, that's obviously not everybody who gambles does so in a harmful way or in a way that is addictive. Lots of people do it in moderation, just as many people drink alcohol in moderation. But I suppose what we see in our work is the people at the end of the scale who are experiencing harm, who are gambling much more than is good for them, who develop addictions to it and whose lives suffer as a result.
I would imagine that the fact of the pandemic has impacted the amount of money gambled in Ireland and across the world last year, also the amount of money lost, and it remains to be seen whether that trend will continue. Whether it does or whether it doesn't, this particular index does highlight where Ireland falls both in the European Union and indeed globally, 14th for the average highest losses on gambling. And even, Barry, as you say, if a proportion of people who were gambling weren't engaged in harmful gambling, it does underscore a very significant problem for many people in Ireland.
Absolutely. It's estimated, I think, in the article in today's Times, they're talking about 55,000 people with a gambling problem in the most recent report or recent estimation that's there. And the research would show that there's anywhere between 8 and 10 additional people affected for every person with a gambling problem. So you're easily up in 500,000 people in a very small population who will be experiencing some level of gambling-related harm, whether it's through their own addiction or through a loved one's addiction.
Does Ireland have a particular problem with gambling or a particular problem with its regulation?
It's probably a bit of both. I mean, the absence of regulation facilitates more, I suppose, irresponsible gambling. So, I mean, in an ideal world, we get responsible policy at government level, responsible provision of services by the gambling operators, and responsible consumption by the punter, right, by the customer. Now, we don't have responsible policy, so, of course, the knock-on of that is that we're not going to have very responsible provision. That's not true universally, but some operators are more responsible than others. And then in the absence of those things, it makes it much easier, kind of creates an environment where people are much more likely to gamble in a harmful way. So we need joined up thinking, and it needs to start at government level. We're 8 years. This week is the 8th anniversary of the publication of the Gambling Control Bill back in 2013. We're still waiting for that regulation to come in.
Why?
Oh, God, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I've been asking politicians for about the last 5 or 6 years since I started out on this project. The answer that people generally give me is that it's complicated. Now, other jurisdictions in other parts of the world have managed to crack that nut, even in a complicated, you know, online world where I suppose gambling addiction is very different to other addictions in that you don't need a physical substance. It's not tied down to a geographical space. So, I mean, I could pick up my phone and, like, in two clicks, I could be gambling on a gambling website that's based in Curacao or Malta or Cyprus or anywhere else in the world. So it is different to, I suppose, some other things that are regulated and some other things that are addictive. But having said that, most other jurisdictions in the world have figured out how to do this regulation piece around it. So long story short, I wish I knew why it was still taking so long, but that tends to be the argument that comes back from government, is that it's a complex area. I don't think it's that complicated.
In fairness, many of the areas in which governments across the world legislate are complex, so I don't know that that's necessarily, you know, a particularly robust argument against an 8-year delay. How much of it all, Barry, do you think the lack of understanding of gambling as an addiction may feed into the pace at which this law has not been enacted?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, and that's something we come across every day in our counselling work, is that your average person in the street understands full well that alcohol is addictive, illicit drugs are addictive. Most people can't wrap their heads around the fact that a behaviour like gambling can become addictive. But for anybody listening today who still doesn't understand how gambling can be addictive, try this out for 1 week, no social media, right? And then come back to me and let me know how you get on, because behaviours can be addictive, right? And especially if they're designed to be addictive, as most gambling products are, as social media is. So that is definitely a factor in that at government level, across society, your average person doesn't understand how a person can become addicted to gambling. People think that person is just being irresponsible or selfish or whatever it is. That's unfortunately, the products are very, very addictive, especially in the online space. I mean, that article today mentions nearly half of people who gamble online gamble on a mobile device now. Now, NUIG put out a piece of research earlier this year that showed that roughly half of people who gamble on smartphones or other mobile devices will develop a gambling problem.
Right, I would imagine part of that is because there's no cash flowing through their hands. So they're not looking at the 20 euro, the 50 euro, the 10 euro note. It's just numbers on a phone.
Absolutely. And that's a huge part of what a lot of people will tell you, especially people who started out gambling, say, in physical bookie shops or in physical arcades. Then they move online. Totally different ballgame. It's like playing a video game. It's just numbers on a screen. It could be your month's wages and it's gone in a day. We work with loads of people who are in that situation. So that is part of it, where the money doesn't seem real. Also, there's no closing time online. Like your bookie shop on the high street in Kildare, in any other part of the country, closes at a certain time and opens up again in the morning. But your online is open 24/7. Most of the people we work with are gambling well into the night. gambling on sports that they know little about, just because they're chasing their losses, or they're hooked, so they just can't stop. Even when they're winning, they'll keep going. So unfortunately, the online space makes something that was already addictive, you know, traditionally a certain amount of people would have always gotten addicted to gambling, in the online space it's like supercharging that addictive nature of the gambling process.
If anybody, Barry, listening to you talk, feels that they want to reach out, they need more help or support, how can they get in touch with you?
If they want to call our helpline number, that's 089-241-5401. Or else if they just go to problemgambling.ie, the details of our free counselling service and helpline service are all there.
Well, Barry Grant, Chief Executive of Extern Problem Gambling, thank you indeed for joining us. And that helpline number again, 089-241-5401, or you can visit problemgambling.ie. Paul is up after the news at 3. He'll bring you Classic Gold, followed then by K-Drive. We'll have the edition of Monday at the Movies with Thomas Marr from 7 o'clock this evening. Liam will be along at 8 p.m. tonight with K Country. You can hear a reprise of Kildare Today and indeed Kildare Focus from 10 o'clock this evening. And Clem Ryan will be back in the hot seat for Tuesday's edition of Kildare Today from 9 a.m. My thanks to all of you for your company this afternoon. Particular thanks to a Kildare Focus producer, Owen Beattie.